I'm Ivester. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. They're about to get me cross-eyed looking right straight at the mic. My sobriety date is February 2nd of 57. And thank you very much. God knows if I make it, what is that, 15 more days, something like that, it'll be 47 years. God knows that's a long time. Long time. If I don't know if it's going to last that long, I'd have quit. That's never meant to stay sober this long. Never meant to get this good. I'm so darn good, I'm boring. No, I'm having a great time, but I swear I never did mean to do this much. I want to congratulate the Roseville Tuesday Night Group. I also want to congratulate whoever the creative genius was that named that group. I'll bet you it meets in Roseville on Tuesday night. That's that incredible alcoholic mind at work. That really is a significant thing, 59 years of continuous practice of a group. And I'm just delighted to be here for that occasion and congratulate folks, the early folk in that group who stuck with it and seen it through the years. That's a great deal. Also glad to see us pause to just kind of honor that. And it's super to see the turnout. That's a great showing of support for this AA piece of the world. So I'm just glad to be a part of that. I want to tell you about what we do here is tell our stories. You know, we don't lecture, preach, or teach. I don't know what the gavel's for. Rowdy drunks, I guess. I don't know what that is. But that's what we do is tell our story. That's what I want to do now. I'll tell some of mine. When I first got in the program and watched people telling their story, I thought, my God, how could anybody talk that long? Now the question is, how do you get it in that time? Memory improves. I think I'm, it's for sort of an average type of drunk. I don't think I'm anybody special. I tell you what I want to get at a little bit tonight. I've got group on my mind, I guess, because of what we're bringing us together here for this occasion. I was sitting in my group, my home group, on Christmas night. And on Christmas night, we normally don't have a real highly planned program. We have a sort of an intimate gathering, and we just sort of sit around, love each other, and talk a little bit about what's on our mind. And so what we do is just have a little quick call-up meeting with asking some of the members to share what's on their heart and mind at that time. So I'm sitting there listening, and they called on me, and I got up and I shared. Let me tell you what I shared with my group. And what I think I'd like to tickle around a little bit with here tonight. What I shared with my group at night was what it was that had me sort of filled with gratitude that night. And it was the appreciation that I felt for my home group, that it's a special kind of a place where I feel secure, I feel useful, I feel a sense of solution, I feel a sense of real achievement and real belonging. And what makes me feel that way is not because we are an exceptionally nice bunch of people or overly personable or friendly. I mean, we may be some of all of that. But what makes us that way is not what we are, it's what we do. Because we are a group of Alcoholics Anonymous that practices all legacies, full speed ahead, and we do stuff. You know, we believe the fifth tradition is almost like a job description for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what we do. We actively carry the message to alcoholics, to the alcoholic who still suffers. And that's the thing that made me feel good to be sitting in that place that night, reflecting on the value that that group has for me. And somewhere along the line tonight, if I don't get too carried away with something else, I'd like to just visit that neighborhood a little bit because I think that's such an important quality in the program. And like I started to say, I'm just sort of an average guy. I think we come in two basic varieties. We alcoholics come in two basic varieties. One is the type, old-fashioned type, who starts drinking, seems to drink with relative control for a number of years, and then somehow or other just loses control and kind of goes off the deep end and never to be seen again unless somebody throws him a rope and he gets in here. That's a real alcoholic, no question about it. There's another type, of which I think I was an early model of the other type, who's a basket case from day one. Never has a training period, starts out on the bottom, it gets worse. And looks to me like we've got more and more of those and fewer of the others. That's amazing to me how quickly people get in trouble now. And my God, man, you see people freshmen in high school that's as bad as I was in my worst days. And so it's just amazing how quickly folks get in trouble. And I think I really was one of the prototypes of that kind of alcoholic. What I know is that I'm a guy who booze just did something special for me. I was a guy that I never was, I know you never heard this before, but I was never somebody real comfortable with this thing called life. I always had a bit of discomfort, a bit of uneasiness, a bit of lacking in the confidence and security that I felt good about who I was, what it was about. I always was that way. And in my teenage years and in my early years, I did a little bit of sneaking drinking, but my first significant drinking started when I was 16 years old. And that was the first time that I drank my liquor under my conditions, and man, I'm telling you, something important happened to me. There was absolutely a change in me that was marvelous to behold. That same awkward, clumsy, big-eared, skinny kid all at once turned into a guy with a whole lot of savoir-faire. Whatever that is. I had it. I had that sucker up to the ears. That was a wonderful feeling. I was freed. I was like a bird out of a cage. Man, that stuff hit, clicked. I took off like a wild man and darn near didn't stop. I fell in love with it. I wasn't an alcoholic. Wasn't born alcoholic. Wasn't an instant alcoholic. Wasn't an alcoholic at all. I was a miserable young guy who found a marvelous solution in booze. I would have been stupid to not drink. My God, that's the cheapest relief I ever had in my life. It was the most dependable relief I ever had in my life. It was the most reliable friend I ever had in my life. And man, I could get $2 worth of moonshine whiskey and go to the moon. Good God, I'd have been stupid to stay on earth. So I just took off. I fell in love with it, loved the feeling. I loved the effect. I loved what it did for me. I love how it turned me loose in the life that it introduced me to. I fell in love with the drinking life. Loved that stuff. I loved all the action and the shucking and jiving and all of the stuff of waking up in strange places with strange people, and life was just a never-ending adventure. Caused a few difficulties. Now, I drank a lot. To the untrained eye, it would have appeared that I drank too much. But not so. I don't think I ever drank too much in my life. I drank about the right amount. All I could get. I don't ever remember a single time, alcoholic or not, when I thought I had enough. I have never had the feeling, I swear I marvel at it to this day, of people who say, "No, thank you, I've had enough." I have never uttered those words in my life. I won't even utter them on somebody else's behalf. That's foreign language to me. I've been so drunk I couldn't lay on that floor. And somebody say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" Yeah, one more. I mean, that was me. I wasn't an alcoholic. I just loved that euphoria. I loved that release, and I loved what it did for me. I loved that raunchy-looking crowd of folk. And so I drank a considerable amount. And when you drink a lot, stuff happens. I mean, stuff just happens. You go to jail a lot. I did. I still don't understand this, but there are a good number of alcoholics who don't go to jail. I don't know what's wrong with them, but there's alcoholics who do not go. I bet there's some here that are guilty of never going to jail. Must have hid. I don't know how you could do that. We did a survey way back a long time ago in 1960. We did a survey in Charlotte, our largest city. Have you ever been in jail as much as overnight? Now, this was back in the old days, eh? When we had real alcoholics. We had bad alcoholics. What do you think it was? The percentage that had been in jail as much as overnight. 30%. I almost quit. I thought, these ain't real alcoholics. But I don't know if it's a commentary on a different pattern of drinking with some alcoholics, or just a commentary on poor law enforcement. I suspect the latter. Anyway, that for some, that becomes an occupational hazard. I went to jail a lot. I wasn't particularly a vicious guy. I didn't overtly create trouble. I just got in the way a lot. I would like to say about cockroaches. Folks don't dislike cockroaches because of what they eat or carry off. They don't like them because of what they fall in and mess up. And that's the way I was. I didn't carry off much, but I would fall out in the most ungodly places. I always loved a nice place. Now, I loved a nice joint for a while. A nice joint to me was one that had carpet on the floor and an organ. My idea of heaven on earth would be in one of those cool, dark caves with some old fat boy over playing Malagueña on the organ or somewhere. And my God, that was just nirvana to me. I could have stayed there for the rest of my life and loved it. I loved that kind of place, but I had a strange tendency to slide off the bar stool and hit the floor and throw up on somebody's carpet. Now, that's a little testy. And, if you're trying to run a decent place, you got some big old drunk stretched out all the floor, what are you going to do with him? Step over him? He's just there, and doesn't look like decoration. So you call the police. And so I went to jail an awful lot just because of what I got into. So I was that kind of guy. And so that's the kind of fellow I was. I got caught up into that kind of scuffling along wild, crazy stuff. And I'll tell you this, I would still be doing that tonight, except for one thing. I developed alcoholism. I don't particularly know why. Don't care why, really. There are all kinds of interesting concepts about why people become alcoholic. I find most of them pretty interesting. I also find most of them totally unimportant in terms of my recovery. I don't have no clue whether it's chemical, biological, psychological, environmental, social, name it. I have no clue nor care. The most important thing that I know about alcoholism is that I have it. I think I understand less about it now than I did the day I came in here. Now, I've listened to a lot of lectures, and I've read books, and I've seen movies about it. I've listened to far more than I wanted to hear about it. And it hadn't made me any smarter. It kind of bored me a little. But it's just kind of interesting stuff. But what difference does it make? What difference does it make? In terms of my recovery, it isn't important to me that I understand the etiology of alcoholism. What's important is that I understand that I've got that sucker. And it doesn't matter where it came from. Now, if I've got time on my hands and I want to dabble in some kind of intellectual pursuit, I can do that. But it isn't going to change the fact I've got it. Really don't understand it. I don't understand what it was that happened to me. We commonly refer to what happened to me as crossing a line from that kind of wild, but it was bad enough before I was alcoholic. But alcoholism is what happened when what we call crossing the line. Now, that isn't written anywhere. You'll never find any scientific explanation of that. But it's a good description of what happened. Because after I got sober and looked back on my life, I could recognize with some clarity that along in my 18th year, after a relatively short period of that kind of wild, crazy drinking, something happened so that my life changed and would never be the same again when it comes to alcohol. Our book defines extremely well for me, in a simple little sentence, where it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Amen. I like that definition. I like that definition because it has nothing to do with the circumstances surrounding my drinking. It has nothing to do with how long I drank, how much I drank, what I drank, or what I did when I drank. It has nothing to do with whether I went to jail or didn't go to jail, whether I got married to somebody I didn't know or didn't, and I did. That's an occupational hazard of drunk, I'll guarantee you. But that doesn't define alcoholism. You know, there are alcoholics who've never done any of that. And so circumstances don't define it. Hear the definition. We alcoholics are men and women who lost the ability to control our drinking. Now, I didn't know it when it happened, but when I crossed that line, my life changed irretrievably. In the sense that if I take a drink of anything with alcohol in it, I cannot predict what I will do. Don't need to understand that. Something happened. I don't understand craving. But I'll guarantee you I know what it feels like. I know what craving is. I know what it's like to go home too soon and get up and walk somewhere to a bootlegger to get a drink because I'm gnawing with craving. I know that. I don't know about the obsession of the mind, but I know I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic because that's what I am. What other kind would I have? And I have a mind that can at times turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink. I don't understand that, don't need to, but I have experienced that. And so that's what happened to me. And if it had not been for that simple little crossing of that line into something called alcoholism, I would be drinking tonight. I would have never stopped. Why would I? Why would I? But I developed that inability. And my life from that point forward, I've talked long about this already, I meant to, but my life from that point forward, I guess to an observer who was watching, it would have been relatively predictable because of how much you could rely on what would happen when I drank. But on the inside, I never saw what was happening. And strangely to me, my life from that point, it was like I was just absolutely going on a downhill, just a race downhill. And my life was made up of just a seemingly endless series of failures and new beginnings. Failures and new beginnings. And every time I would fail somewhere and start over again, what I didn't recognize was that I would go down another notch and another notch. So that in 8 short years, from the time I started serious drinking, in 8 short years, my life completely changed from that fairly bright young fellow who bounced out of high school, 16, set out to go somewhere in the world. 8 years later, I'm living on the streets up in the city of Flint, Michigan. Now, I didn't go there. I didn't just discover myself there. I worked my way there incrementally, one failure and new start after another. What was really profoundly difficult for me to understand was that I never saw that pattern. I never saw the pattern of my behavior clearly till I was sober. Now, I don't know about you, if you saw things in this frame of reference, but my life, when I became unable to predict what I would do, my life became almost a constant rerun of coming to in the latest bizarre circumstance, whatever it was. Yeah, wrong state, burning car, on the street, married to that old girl. Yeah, I'd be just coming to in these god-awful situations. And when I would come to and sort of get a look at where I was and look at the latest wreckage, there would always proceed a most predictable ritual. I would say, well, you've done it again. You're no good. You're worthless. You're irresponsible. You have no character. All of which might have had an element of truth. None of which had anything to do with the problem. So I would go through that thing. You've done it again. You worthless dog. And then would consider the options. What are you going to do now? Why don't you just hang it up? Why don't you just do yourself in everybody would be better off, would nearly always be the first thought. Or if not that, why don't you just keep going, get out of people's lives and give them a break? Or do you suck it up and make up a new set of lies and go back? You know, our book refers to that. And when I first started reading it, it didn't register with me, in all honesty. I thought Bill waxed a little eloquent down on that chapter in alcoholism where he used some phrasing that was kind of foreign to me. He referred to what I'm talking about right now as pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, eh? And that's exactly what that was. That time when the consequences of my life just come thundering in, and I am beat. I am absolutely beat. And we've got a simpler name for that. We call it bottom. You know, bottom's not a one-time thing. Bottom is a many-time thing. And so every time I hit that kind of a plateau, I was at a bottom. But I turned to the only solution I knew. And that was another drink would have made no sense to anybody who was observing the behavior. It's the only thing that made sense to me. And that's that squirrel cage of drinking that was my alcoholism. And in the course of all that, my life is just steadily going downhill. And I wound up in Michigan. I used to say I live by my wits, but that's not exactly true. I live by my lack of character. I know of darn little that a man could do that I haven't done. Now, if I didn't do it, I just didn't think of it. I didn't reject anything on moral grounds, I will assure you of that. Now, I wasn't reared to be a street thug, and that's not what I was. I was an alcoholic living in the jungle. And when you live in the jungle, you live by the laws of the jungle, you don't live. Simple as that. And what I did during those days, I, honest to God, did not think of it as criminality. No, really today. It was sort of the way the food chain worked. One day I might be the friskiest and I drank. The next day the other guy was the friskiest and he drank. I never believed I would get reduced to living in that. That was a totally foreign notion to me. But by the time I got there, it was the only normal-looking life. And what would have been unthinkable at one time became as normal as breathing. Never believed that. Never believed I would be surviving by hustling and scheming and using people, taking advantage of folk, selling my blood $5 a throw. That's what the guys did. That's what I did. And I'm confident, man, I'd have let them pump me dry if I hadn't had controls on it. So I was just one of those kind of guys. I was just one of those sort of quick episodic careers that just crashed. And I have absolutely no doubt today that had I not been brought to a stop, I would have drunk myself to death. I don't have any question about that. You know, guys like me don't make old drunks. And I never thought I'd make 30. Don't think I would have. And unfortunately, I was brought to a stop, but not soon enough and not surely enough, in a very tragic way, not in terms of what happened to me, but in terms of what I did. One morning I woke up in the Genesee County Jail where I was living up in Flint. And after I was up a while, the jailer came by. I knew him well. And I said, "When can I get out?" And he said, "I hope never." And walked off. And I had not a clue what he was talking about. But I knew he wasn't kidding. And then some of the other guys in there told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city and had run down and killed two people. And the only thing they did wrong was try to cross the street in front of some idiot like me. And so that's who I was. I'm driving blind, drunk, blacked out down the main street, hit two people, didn't even know it. Didn't even know it. The policeman, later on, one of the policemen said that I came walking back. I'd seen there was an accident. Said, "Was there an accident?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "I think I might have been in it." And that's what he said, and I said. But I don't know. I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever. I just know that I was greeted with that information. And, you know, even though I was living a pretty wild and goofy life, you know, I was never a subhuman with a lack of sensitivity to people. And that was extremely devastating news to me. I could not handle it. I just couldn't. I could believe it, but I couldn't take it in, if you know what I mean. I couldn't handle the information and just pretended it wasn't so. And then, of course, finally came through. I stayed in there for almost 3 months before my family ever knew anything had happened. They lived down in North Carolina, and then one of the policemen there, that for whatever reason, decided to contact them, let them know they had a guy friend in a lot of trouble, and my folks came up, got me out on bond. I didn't want out, but I didn't know how to say that. And so they got me out on bond. I knew I wouldn't drink. I thought it would be physically impossible. I stayed sober a day and a half. And of course I drank. From July to November of 56. My last drink was actually November 19th of 56. I hope and pray it was my last one. Been last one so far. And that day I finished a bottle of gin and went to court. It was not a trial. I had no defense. I mean, how do you defend anything like that? And so I went in and knew that I wouldn't be coming back out. And I was tried on a charge of involuntary manslaughter, found guilty, of course, and sentenced to a max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, as you gathered, I was not a hothouse flower. But there is a striking difference between a maximum custody penitentiary and an overnight drunk tank. And my history had been pretty much drunk tanks and stockades and the military, stuff like that. And when that judge passed that sentence, I had a very normal, instinctive reaction of fear, but same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. There wouldn't be any more. And next day, walked into that institution, resigned to my fate, never believed I would ever come out of there alive. And again, I believe that prediction would have been true had it not been for the marvelous intervention, if you want to call it that, that we celebrate here tonight. Had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous, I guarantee you I would have never come out of there alive. If I'd gone in there and tried to get by on my street moxie, I wouldn't have lasted till supper. And I know that. And so I went in there. I was an extremely devastated young fellow. I was almost comatose. I was aware. But I was incommunicado. I wouldn't talk to people. I didn't visit with people. And all I did was sit and stare or read to keep from thinking is all I did. And one day, it's amazing what constitutes turning points, isn't it? Everybody here has had many turning points just like me. Every one of us in this room has had a critical, Karen here tonight with that, so every one of us has had a critical turning point where we've moved in the right direction. And hey, Tony, bless your heart. If I could reach you, I'd kiss you. It's not a threat, but I love you, buddy. I would marry him, but I can't spell his last name. But he's my buddy. That's who I was. I was sitting there. And the reason I said what I did in the beginning, and you can take this to the bank. If my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, or if my approach to Alcoholics Anonymous had depended on any initiative on my part, I would have never come. I would have never come. And what I mean by that is not that I was some special case. I was too far gone. I was too far out of reach. I'd never heard of anybody helping a drunk. I'd never heard of anything. I mean, this was a long time ago, and it certainly wasn't well known back then. But I mean, AA was around, I guess. We had 125,000 members when I came in, but I never heard of it. And what happened that proved to be a major turning point in my life was a very simple thing. A guy called me out for an interview one day, a fellow that worked there at the institution, asked me the usual social work stuff of family history and social history and all that. And when he got through, he made the same diagnosis that everybody who had ever captured me made. Man, you sure drink a lot, or you're an alcoholic, or you're a drunk. And I'd heard that stuff ad nauseum. And then when he got, normally when people got through with that, they'd say, you ought to quit drinking, or some nonsensical thing like that. Nobody ever suggested anything you do about it. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I thought I was a 24-year-old budding rocket scientist who was getting ready to happen. That's really what I believed, because I had moments of brilliance marked by vast prairies of failure, but I remembered the brilliance, you know. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I knew I was too young. I knew I had too much bubbling potential. And so this guy had made the same declaration. You've had a lot of trouble with booze. I said, yes, sir. He said, I really appreciate the tone of what he did. He said, Well, we have an AA group. I never heard this. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution. I think you ought to go. And it was just as matter of fact to say, if you need a haircut, there's a barbershop over there. About that casual. And, I mean, there's no histrionics, and he didn't say, well, you will never get out of here. We'll punish you forever if you don't go. I mean, nothing like that. It's just an observation. Man, you got trouble. They fixed it. You ought to go over there. And I wouldn't have gone just on that. But God, how powerful that experience was. Not the message, but the experience. This much so. That has been well over 47 years ago. And from that day, I've never looked back. I mean, that simple little thing, suggestion really, was a huge turning point in my life, and I've never looked back. Responded to the first invitation I ever heard. And so I walked in, shuffled in really to my first meeting on February 2nd. I didn't know what to expect. I was not thrilled about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys might have all been just thrilled out of, to pieces to be coming to AA. I thought my life was over. I thought about it when he had told me I could go and gave me a date. I thought about it and it seemed sad to me. You know, I mean, it looked like we could have found a better name for this thing. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous. Jesus, that is not an upbeat sound. You know, that secret drunks. Who wants to be one of them? Yeah, I mean, it looks like we could have named it the Rainbow Club or something. I mean, I understand it now. It's more therapy than title, but nonetheless, it's not attractive. And my image of it was going to be sad singing and slow riding. And I figured it was going to be a camp meeting, a revival type of thing. What else are you going to do with a whole gaggle of drunks? And I figured, man, they're going to come at us big time. So I went over there braced for that. I had absolutely zero spiritual quality. I mean, none. Where there should have been something, there was a big empty place. And so I walked in. First thing they did was pray. Same one we did here tonight. Same prayer. Hadn't changed a lick. And I said, yep, see there? Knew it was coming. And then they got up and read that stuff. Sounded just like church. Sounded like they're reading scriptures, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Thank God they didn't sing. They did. They did take up collections, but it's all church-like stuff, you know. And so I'm sitting there cringing in the middle of this stuff. And then they introduced the speaker, and the guy that got up spoke. His name was George Walker. Everybody called him Shy, including himself. He was just a remarkable man. He got up and told his story. And I'd heard alcoholics tell stories, but not their own. This guy told his own. He told a story I wouldn't have told anybody as drunk as I'd ever been. And I thought, why is he doing that? I mean, it made no sense to me. And he was awful. He really was awful. I didn't identify with anything the man said. I mean, nothing. When I left there, I was surely more confused than I walked in, because I just seen a complete yo-yo getting up telling 300 hairy-legged convicts some god-awful yarn. And I had no sense of understanding of that stuff. I will absolutely guarantee you I didn't feel like I'd found my planet at last. No, this was not homecoming for me. I felt out of place. You know, I was 24 years old. Now, that's not tremendously young by today's standard. It's still fairly young. But it was incredibly young in 1957. I was the youngest member in every meeting I attended for years. Youngest member in my entire state. Started the first young people's group in North Carolina. Yeah, I was an extremely young fella. And the first day I walked in, there wasn't a guy in the room didn't outweigh me by 25 years of drinking. And I felt like a wimp, man. I'm sitting in there, just a little old kid sitting in there with that bunch of old orangutans. And so I felt totally out of place. I sure didn't identify with Shy. And when I left, if anything in my head was buzzing, I guess. And the amazing thing was, the next week I was back. Nobody came for me. Nobody called for me. I just found myself back. And I believe the only thing that brought me back was the magical appeal of that guy's enthusiasm. He was one of the most enthusiastic people I ever met in my life. And that's what drew me back. I couldn't have explained to anybody why I was back. Didn't have to. I just sat down. And the way I like to look at it, I sat down in a sea of faces. There were 300 guys in that group. And I'm just one more tragic, lost face in the crowd. That's all. I didn't feel any sense of community, didn't feel any sense of belonging. Didn't believe I was an alcoholic. Said I was because I hated to be the only something else in the crowd. So they all said they were. And I said, yeah, me too. But it didn't mean a thing. Not a thing. And so I kept going back. And some stuff started to happen. The group that I went in, the recovery group of Jackson Prison, was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous by any standard. I belong to a fine group right now, but it's no better, thank God, than that first one I went in, because it was a group with a well-defined sense of purpose. It was a group that did a great job of taking newcomers and introducing them to this way of life. First place I ever heard the term "designed for living" was from a bunch of other guys in the joint who had learned a bit more than me and were sharing with me. First time I ever heard that term, designed for living. And how, oh God, how much that meant to me. That this is not some evangelical happening. It's not some charismatic experience. It's not some mystical event that happens to somebody from out of the blue. Alcoholics Anonymous is not predicated on that. Alcoholics Anonymous is a design for living. And what was taught to me in this program and what I've come to know is true. That if I take the actions that are laid out in the program, the results will happen. And I don't care what the motives are. I didn't even have any motives. I'm just a body being shuffled around. And I took the actions and the results happened. I tell you, it's been a lot of years since I've even wasted one second of time considering somebody's motives. I don't care. Motives are none of my business. My business is trying to pick up on a broken and wasted life and help it get back together. And so it's amazing to me to understand that this program's not about snapping into goodness. It's a design for living. It's to help desperate people get well. Not good. Well. And if goodness comes, too bad. It just happens sometimes. Like I told you, I tell you, I'm borderline pure. I am awful. I don't do anything. No, I have more fun than most people. That stuff started to happen. You know, and it wasn't just mystical. Those were very tangible, specific things that were going on. I read everything we had. We didn't have much back then. We only had 12 publications total when I came in. And I was coming down off speed. Man, I could read those suckers the first week. It didn't take me long to read back then. I mean, zzzz. Didn't mean much, but it kept me busy for a while. And in the course of it, you know, I started picking up some stuff. And somewhere along the line, I got involved in action, in the real actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody ever recruited me into service. I mean, it was just a natural. You know, people said, come on, where are you going? Don't worry, come on, we go. And so I got into service when I was locked up and found the great joys of service when I was locked up. I'll tell you this, just from a program standpoint. I'm a great believer in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't just believe, I know. I know about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got into this program and I took the actions, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that Alcoholics Anonymous can reward a person with that didn't come to me when I was locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary. Nothing. There was no gift that was pending my release. Because this is about the soul. This is about the spirit. It's not about what kind of container the body's in. I became a free man for the first time in my entire life, locked up like a wild animal. And I became a free man in all the ways that matter. I became a happy man for the first time in my entire life, locked up behind a 40-foot wall. And I became a happy man. I became usefully whole, as is promised in our program. I learned to have a sense of worth from doing worthwhile things in a maximum custody penitentiary. So I'm somebody who doesn't speculate about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm somebody who knows about the power of this program. It made me a free man. It helped me go through 3.5 years of confinement in a maximum custody penitentiary and leave there a better man than I came in, not psychologically or physically damaged in any way, but a man who had started to become grown and started to become a useless one of God's kids, a useful one of God's kids. And I had a marvelous time in AA in there. Now, I hated that place with a purple passion. I had some idiots tell me when I first went in there that I'd get used to it after a while. It obviously takes more than 3.5 years. I hated it worse the day I walked in than I did the day I walked out. And you know, I think you could understand this little commentary about getting caught up in. I had a minister friend that one time that said that when he looked at AA, the way he liked to describe the experience was being expelled to a new affection. Being expelled to a new affection. And God, how true that is. I didn't solve a drinking problem. I found a new way of life. I found a new way of life that's a new affection. And I got so caught up in that in a lot, as much as I hated the penitentiary. They told me they would let me go if I would agree to go to North Carolina. So I told them, let me take that under consideration. And for about a millisecond, I took it under consideration. But when I started getting ready to go, the night before I was leaving, as much as I hated that place, the night before I was leaving, I found myself thinking, geez, I need a couple more days just to finish up some of my AA stuff. Now, I didn't tell anybody. I did not tell a soul that because I wouldn't have done one more second. But isn't that great to be walking out of purgatory saying, yeah, I need a little bit more time, but I don't think I'll do it. You know, I think that's great. That's freedom. That's joy. You know, that's not about the physical stuff. That's about the spirit soaring. And when I hit the street, it was just a matter of keeping on with what I was doing. You know, the best way in the world to prepare for transition, like moving to the desert or whatever. Anytime we're going for transition, the best preparation for transition is to be solid in the program. And if you're solid in the program, all you got to do is change home groups. And if you're like me, you probably have to start one because it's hard to find sometimes a good home group. So I was solid in the program, and when I hit the street, I won't linger on this too long, because they told me that at exactly 74 minutes after I started, a trap door opened down here, and there are crocodiles underneath. So I want to hear some noise over there if I get anywhere close to it, Dave. Y'all make noise. I hate to have to hurt you, but I'll put Bill on you. When I hit the street, I just say this kind of in the interest of this business of starting group. When I hit the street, the first meeting I went to, the first night I visited a little group, and then the next night I went to one that was going to be my home group. And I tell you something, folks, that was the worst AA meeting I've ever been to in my life. If we'd have had a meeting that bad in jail, somebody would have got hurt. I mean, we didn't do AA like that. I mean, it sucked. It was really a bad meeting. And I sat there thinking, gee whiz, man, what is this? And Charlotte was 25 miles away, and I said, I'm not going to hang over here with these meatheads. I'm going to Charlotte where the action is, you know. Well, I took a look around, and I observed a disturbing thing. I was the second oldest guy in the group, and the guy that was older than me was kind of over the hill. I mean, he wasn't going to build any brave new worlds. I mean, he sort of gone over. And, I had a disturbing thought that comes sometime. When do you become responsible, big boy? When do you become responsible? Ain't nobody look around and call for help. And so I decided, one of the few wise decisions I made, I decided to stay there and take a stand. And I tell you, I had that. I wasn't in the same league, but I think about it like this thing with Bowen doing this thing here in Roseville. You think about this for a second in terms of the context of this group and what I'm telling you about the one I went into. Everywhere that Alcoholics Anonymous exists, everywhere, particularly in that early wave in the early 40s when the publicity started to hit the street and they started to have exponential kind of growth, Every place that AA started to grow was because one alcoholic planted the flag and said, "We'll stand here." Somebody said that in Roseville. Said, "We'll stand here." Now, I didn't know what I was doing, but that's exactly what I was doing in my own kind of fumbling way. When I walked out of that penitentiary and I walked into a meeting, it was terrible. And I started to run away, and I said, "No, it's about time to take some responsibility. We'll stand here." Wise decision. Wise decision. And I had the marvelous experience of helping Alcoholics Anonymous come alive in a city. And it's an experience second to none. I've had that marvelous experience of going to many meetings alone. I'm the only one there. And they're strange feelings, but good meetings. I mean, a business meeting's a snap. I mean, you can just sail right through that sucker, and man, you feel like the king of AA. You're right there in charge of that building. But it's a good feeling. It's a good, clean, decent feeling to be taking a stand, eh? And that's what it's about. And so I had that great experience there, and I got immediately active when I left the institution. I got involved in institutional work. Second week I was out. 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of a prison. Now that is certainly a little simpler day than today with some of the rigmarole you have to go through. But I was outside sponsor of a prison 2 months. 2 months after I was out, my parole supervisor asked me about driving. I told him I couldn't. And little over 2 months after I was out, I was restored driving privileges. And you heard the crime that I had. I was supposed to never drive a motor vehicle again. I tell you what I found is that when I give myself to this simple program and I try to practice these principles to the best of my abilities, service opportunities will open up for me, and when God's got work for me to do, walls come down. And I don't care what they are. I know that not only on the evidence of my own life, but God, hundreds and hundreds of my friends around the country who demonstrate that every day. And so it's a powerful thing to me that no matter what the current situation, if I trust this program, like I said, trust God, clean house, help others, amazing things will happen. And they have. 2 years after I was out, I was sitting in my house one day minding my own business, and I got a phone call from the state capitol. And a man introduced himself. I'd met him once. He came to the AA group where I was sponsor, and we just chatted for a minute. I didn't know him at all. But he was on the phone, and I don't know exactly what brought it on, but he asked for Mr. Ivester, and I got on there. It's usually bad news when I ask for Mr. Ivester. And so I got on and I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, Mr. Iverson, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." Now, that's not headline news today. But when this happened with Tom Iverson, there had never been an ex-con in history anywhere hired into anything like that. I knew that. I never aspired to corrections. Who had? Nobody ever thought of it. But for some reason, some people thought of it. So they called me. And so to him, I said, the first thing I said was, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, we've checked you out." And then I said, "Man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine." But inside, you know what I said, there ain't no way. But when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I was employed in 1961 as a rehab officer in the state prison system. And as happens, you know, at least been my experience, when I take on a job and I give it my best, I tend to get kicked up. I like to say till I find my level of incompetency, I guess, is what it is. But if you do good work and really take care of a job, it'll tend to move you along. So I started moving into supervision and then into management. And then one day, it still is an unbelievable kind of scene for me. The director of prisons asked me to come by his office, and he wanted me to do something. And so I went by and we visited a minute, and he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." And I mean, you know, I'm working in the system. But I mean, I was mud wrestling with the guys, you know. I mean, I'm duking it out, you know, we're doing a lot of stuff, and I'm having a wonderful time. He's talking about being the man. He's talking about being the Uzi guy. And the guy, and I said, "Boss, come on now, man. I don't want to be the man. I want to just duke it out." And see, and I said, "What do you got in mind?" He told me, and it made some sense. And I said, "Okay, well, will you give me some time to think?" And he said, "Oh, sure, take 5 minutes." And that's literally what he gave me, was 5 minutes. And I took the 5 minutes, went out there, paced up down that hall, prayed hard, went to the John, do my best praying in the John. And then I said, "Okay, fine." And so I went back and told him I'd do it. And then for the next 20 years, that's what I did. It's an unbelievable thing. I will assure you, of all the men and women sitting in maximum custody penitentiaries tonight in this world, I bet none of them are saying, "One of these days I'm going to run one of these dudes. If you just let me, you just let me out of here, but I'm going to run this sucker and show you how." That's what happened, and a marvelous career. That's absolutely great. I'm not a professional ex-convict. I don't know of anybody interested in professional ex-convicts. I don't know of anybody interested in hiring ex-convicts. I will guarantee you nobody's recruiting wardens from a resume of ex-convict. I was not super qualified. But I don't know, they must have seen some ability in me. You know, that we kid around about potential. But I really believe that alcoholics tend to have a lot of potential. I got into a profession I wasn't even looking for, and I went to the very top of my profession. Now, I was not somebody hired because I was a gimmick. I finished my education in correctional administration. I worked as a professional. I was not some circus display. You know, I worked professionally. I never even knew whether people knew my history or not. Nobody ever discussed it with me. I went on about the business and took my place there and had an absolutely marvelous career. I wouldn't trade it for anything. 39 years later, I realized I was 10 years past retirement. And, geez, this is crazy. I'm the oldest guy in the system. I never meant to be that. And I also learned that I'd make as much retired as I would working. And I said, I might as well quit working and do this for nothing. And that's what I do. So I retired, I think it was 3 years ago. I've been so busy, I didn't even count it. I went to work immediately. I went to work as the chairman of what you call H&I for North Carolina the day I retired. And I'm having an absolutely marvelous time. I'm also involved in some stuff in realigning our service structure. I'm involved in a lot of things. I'll just say this, and I won't have time to talk about it much, but I'll just say this. I noticed during the countdown there are a lot of older members here, and there are people who've been around for a considerable time. I don't think our fundamental service ever changes. The most noble thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic meeting head-to-head with another. That's the heart and soul of AA. But as you grow in the program, I think that dimension has to change a bit. Because if I really want to do, you know, like the book says, that it's okay to work on ourselves, but our real purpose is what? To be of maximum effectiveness, usefulness or effectiveness to God and those around us. So how do I become maximally effective? You know, if I just tie myself down working head to head, that'll be valuable, but it'll be very limited. And so if I want to be effective, I have to think a little bit bigger than that. I have to think about the utility of a group. You know, a group is not a place for me to go. A place for me is a place where I go to work. My home group is where I do my basic service work. And so I'm a great believer in that. You know, I can work with an alcoholic and I can pump him up and get him ready to go to AA. But if I don't have a group that delivers on what I promise, then I'm conning folk. And so my group becomes a part of my arsenal. If I can't take the person there with full confidence that they're going to be in a healing, solution-oriented environment, then I'm faking them out. And so a group is a very important place for me. It is where I do my best work. I'm a guy who trolls for drunks. My favorite deal is I just hang around and I kind of watch. I watch the door and I want to see some sucker looks like the vultures are after him come in there, and I'll get there before the vultures do, because I'm going to latch on to that sucker. I may not hold him forever, but I'm going to hold him for a little while. He's going to know that he's got a good chance that he knows he's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he knows there are people who care something about him. And if he wants to go about his business, that's too bad. But I want, that's my deal. And so my group is a big part of where I do my work. It's what makes me able to do my work. And what I was saying in the beginning, my group, there is no service that Alcoholics Anonymous does that is not actively carried out in my group. We have an excellent correctional facility program. I'm chair of that in my group. We have an excellent treatment facilities program. We carry out four things in treatment facilities every week. We have a public information program, cooperation with professional communities. We have a newcomer program that's a real killer. It's a great program. And so we have a group that's geared to effectively working with alcoholics to give them a fighting chance. Now, what that all comes down to me, I have a mission, and I think that's where older members come in. You know, where our experience has led us into some awareness about things in the fellowship, that other thing, if anybody wants to talk about area stuff, I'm in the middle now of realigning our service structure in North Carolina to enhance the effectiveness of our service stuff. Anybody wants to talk about that? I don't know when you'll do it, because Bill's going to take me directly from here to the penitentiary, I think. I believe we're going to talk all night and half a day tomorrow. But it sounds like it anyway. It's a long time. But if anybody wants to talk about that thing, I'd be more than happy to, and folks can tell you how to get in touch with me. I think there's great work to be done. The thing that I just leave this with you, you got your own commitment. I have one commitment, personally imposed. I want the next man, woman, boy, or girl who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous to get as good as I was given. I can't justify any less. And so for that reason, I want to be involved in this thing up to my ears. I'm somebody, I am delighted to tell you, that almost in finishing my 47th year, I am as happy as I've ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous, as involved, as busy, as enthused, as tremendously rewarded as I've ever been. And I'm telling you something, if you're not having a great time, and don't sit around and wither on this thing, jump in this sucker, lay back your ears, and go get it.